area, twisting a Ranger Rick in his hands. The magazine was rolled into a tight, crooked tube. "Nick's not coming," Harper said. "Maybe it's just as well. If Ben Patchett comes by on a spot inspection, he won't think anything of it if you tell him I'm napping. Us pregnant ladies sleep whenever they can. But if he doesn't see any sign of me or Nick, that's going to make him suspicious." When she mentioned the possibility of a spot inspection, Michael seemed to visibly sicken, so much color leaving his face that even his lips looked gray. She wondered if he was having second thoughts, now that the moment had come. She asked, "How we doing?" She was asking about Michael's state of mind, but Don answered instead as if she had inquired about the evening's acts of subterfuge. "The others are already on their way to the island. I met Allie and Renee in the woods with the prisoners. Chuck Cargill is shut into the meat locker. He hollered his head off and kicked the door a bunch of times. But Renee says after you get halfway across the basement, it just blends with the noise from upstairs in the cafeteria." "Go if you're going," Michael said. "I've got things covered here. You don't have to worry, Miss Willows, and you don't have to rush. I can cover for you until the shift change, just before the sun comes up. But those others don't have much time. If the prisoners aren't back across the water in 45 minutes, we're all cooked." Harper stepped toward Michael and put her hands on his to make him stop twisting his Ranger Rick. She leaned in and kissed his cold, dry brow. "You are very brave, Michael," Harper said. "You are one of the bravest people I know. Thank you." Some of the tension went out of his shoulders.
"Don't overrate me, ma'am. I don't see I have a lot of choice. If you love someone, you have to do what you can to keep them safe. I wouldn't want to look back later and think I could have been of use. I could have helped, but I was too scared."
Harper cupped his pink cheek. Michael couldn't meet her eyes. "You ever tell Allie this? That you love her?" He shuffled his feet.
"Not in so many words, ma'am."
He risked a glance into Harper's face.
"You aren't going to say anything to her, are you? I'd appreciate it if you kind of keep what I said between you and me."
"Of course I won't say anything," Harper said. "But don't leave it too long, Mike. These days, I'm not sure it's ever a good idea to leave anything important for tomorrow." Don held the door for her, and she stepped out into the dark and sharp, stinging cold. Every star stood out with a bitter clarity, a needle-tip brightness. Pine boards still zigzagged between buildings, providing walkways, but the snow was gone, and now the planks crossed a humped wasteland of mud. They stepped off the boards to make their way down the hill, through the trees. There was no chance of leaving tracks. At that Arctic hour, the earth was frozen solid, a billion flecks of opalescent ice gleaming in the dirt. Don Lewiston offered her his arm, and she took it, and they made their way like an old married couple over the frozen ground. Halfway to the beach, they paused. A girl was singing from the steeple of the church, her voice sweet and sure. Harper thought it might be one of the neighbor's twins. They both had sung a cappella in high school. Her song carried on the cold, clear air, and the melody was so innocent and sweet it raised goose flesh on Harper's arms. It was an early Taylor Swift tune, a bit of fluff about Romeo and Juliet, which reminded Harper of another, older song about those unhappy, luckless lovers. "There are a lot of good people in this camp," Harper said to Don. "Maybe they've gone along with some bad ideas, but only because they're scared." Don narrowed his eyes, squinted toward the steeple.
"She has a lovely voice, sure. I could listen to that all night. But I wonder if you'd still think so well of this camp if you had heard everyone singing together in chapel a couple hours ago. Or at least, it was singing when they started out. But after a while, everyone was just humming this one long, idiot note. You feel like you're inside of the world's biggest beehive, and everyone around you looks like they're burning from the inside. Their eyes just fackin' blaze. They don't smoke, but they throw heat. So much heat you could just about pass out from it. Sometimes they all get humming so loud I feel like my skull is vibrating, and I just about have to stick a fist in my mouth to keep from screaming."
They resumed walking, the stones and dirt crunching under their feet. "And you can't join in? You don't shine with them?"
"Once or twice, but it ain't treated me right. It's not how hard it hits you, though when I come up out of it, my skull is always ringing so fackin' hard it's like I slammed down a quart of Jack. The worst part isn't forgetting who I am, either. That's bad, though. But thinking I might be Carol is worse. It's like your own thoughts are a faraway radio station, and Carol's station is closer, broadcasting her music right over yours. Hers gets louder and clearer, and yours gets fainter and thinner. You start thinking Father Story is your own dear dad lying in the infirmary with his head mashed in, and the idea that whoever done it hasn't been punished will make you so sick and angry you feel like you're boiling. You'll wonder if someone is going to come bash your head in next, if there are secret forces and whatnot working against you. What you feel in your heart is that if you have to die, you want to die singing, with the whole camp around you, everyone holding hands. You almost hope it will happen, that a cremation crew will come. 'Cause it'd be a relief to get it over with, and you aren't scared of the end, because you'll be burning up with all the people you love right close beside you. Harper shuddered and leaned into Don for warmth. They made their way out onto the dock, and Don helped Harper into the rowboat. She was glad to have his hand clutching her arm, and she stepped down from the dock. She had made the trip across the water often enough over the last few months, but now, for the first time, she felt unsteady on her legs and uncertain of her own balance. In a few deep, steady strokes, they had left the beach behind. Don sat on the thwart between the oars, leaning into each pull and rocking back, his whole body extending into a straight line. He was old, but he was like beef jerky, knotty and tough. Would the eye in the steeple, which sees all the people, observe them now? Don had mentioned to Ben that he might take the boat out to fish tonight. Hopefully their movements on the water this evening would be accepted as Don Lewiston paddling around, looking for flounder, if they were spotted at all. Without any prompting, Don seemed to pick up where he had left off a few minutes before. "It's bad, having a head full of Carol. It's bad not knowing my own name, not knowing my mother's name. But I'll tell you, a month back, we all had a big hard sing, like we do. And then Carol gave a kind of sermon about how there is no history before we got Dragon Scale. That a new history started for each of us when we got sick. That the only life that matters is the life we have now, together, as a community, not the life we had before. And then we sang again, and we all lit up, even me, and we hummed real hard, and afterward we staggered out of there like drunk sailors on New Year's Eve. And I forgot," his breath hitched as he leaned forward to pull against the oars once more. "I forgot my mate, Bill Elroy, what fished with me for 30 years. He was snatched right out of my head. Not just for hours, for days. I had the best years of my life out on the boat with Billy. It's hard to tell you how good they were. We'd fish 3 weeks hard, come back and unload our catch in Portsmouth, then take the boat out to the harbor islands, drop anchor, and drink beer. I'd hate going home. I liked every minute of being with Billy. I liked who I was when I was by his side." He had stopped rowing for a moment. The boat rocked in the swell. "Being with him was like having the whole ocean under you. We didn't talk much, you know. We didn't need to. You don't talk to an ocean and it don't talk back. You just let it carry you." He began to stroke the oars again. "Well, when I suddenly realized I had lost him for a while, that he had been wiped out, that was when I decided I had enough of this place. No one gets to take Bill Elroy from me. Nobody. Not for no reason. No one gets to take our friendship. There was a thief working in this camp last fall, and if Carol had ever caught her, she would have fed her piece by bloody piece to wild dogs. I'll tell you what, though. The things that are stolen from us every night, when we all sing together, those are a lot more important than most of what the thief took. And we know who's taking them. And instead of locking her up, we elected her head of camp." He fell silent. He had taken the extra precaution of rowing them around the northern tip of the island, to the far side of the rock, so he could beach the rowboat where it couldn't be seen from shore by the casual observer. Harper spied two canoes already pulled up on the gravel. Beyond, set back from the water, was the 33-foot cruising sloop sitting in its steel carriage and covered by its taut white tarp. "What do you think happened to the thief, anyway?" Harper asked. "I don't think there's been a theft all winter. Maybe she ran out of things to steal, Don said. Or maybe she just finally got what she wanted. Harper watched Don lean and pull, and thought the power of the bright couldn't compete with being close to someone you loved with all your heart. One took away, the other gave you access to your best, happiest self. I liked who I was when I was by his side, Don Lewiston said, and Harper wondered if there had ever been anyone in her life who made her feel that way about herself. And at that moment the boat ground onto the sand with a wet crunch, and Don said, Let's go see the fireman, huh? 8. Before she climbed out, Harper reached into the bin under the thwart and found her hidden grocery sack, which still contained a bottle of cheap banana-flavored rum and the long box of Galois. Don waited for her halfway up the shale, under the bow of the long white sloop. He had a hand on the hull when she caught up to him. Can you sail it? She asked. He lifted an eyebrow, gave her an amused sidelong glance. All the way around the horn and on to exotic Shanghai, if I had to. I was thinking just a ways up the coast. Yep, he said. Well, that would be easier. They went on arm in arm, through the dunes, up the narrow, weedy trail, over the hill, and onto the fireman's shed. Don lifted the latch and eased the door open onto laughter and warmth and shifting golden light. Renee stood at the furnace, wearing oven mitts and hanging the kettle on its hook over the coals. Gilbert Klein had settled near her, sitting in a straight-backed chair against the wall. He had his gaze on the door when it opened, ready to move if he didn't care for the company, Harper thought. The Maz sat at one end of John Rookwood's cot and John at the other, both of them quivering with laughter. The Maz's wide, ugly face was suffused a deep shade of red, and he was blinking at tears. All of them, all except for Gil, had their eyes on Allie, who stood over a pail, pretending she was a man taking a piss. She wore John's fireman helmet and held a plastic lighter at her crotch. "And this is only the second coolest thing I know how to do with my dick," Allie announced in her intentionally atrocious English accent. She flicked the lighter so her pretend cock spurted flame. "I'll have your campfire going in no time, but if you're really in a hurry to bake your hot dogs, I'll just bend over. And you can—" Allie saw Harper in the doorway, and her voice trailed off. Her grin faltered. She let the lighter go out. John, however, continued to tremble with amusement. He gestured to the Maz and said, "What she just demonstrated, that did happen to me once. But this was years before Dragon Scale, and a little penicillin cleared it right up." The Maz bellowed with laughter, was so raucous it was impossible not to be entertained. The ghost of a smile even briefly reappeared on Allie's lips, but only for a moment. "Wow," Allie said. "Miss Willows, you got huge." "I'm glad to hear your voice, Allie. It's been a while. I've missed it." "I don't know why you would. Mostly when I do open my mouth, it seems like people just get hurt." Her gaze dropped, her face wrinkled with emotion. It was difficult to watch her trying not to cry, all the muscles in her face struggling at once with the strain to hold it in. Harper reached out and took Allie's hands, and when she did, Allie lost the fight and began to weep. "I feel so bad," Allie said. "I think we were supposed to be really good friends, and I fucked it all up, and I'm so sorry." "Oh, Allie," Harper said, and tried to squeeze her. Her stomach made squeezing people tricky, and instead of a hug, she wound up giving Allie a rubbery bump with her belly. Allie made a strangled sound that was part sob, part laugh. "We are really good friends. And to be honest, I had wanted to try a shorter haircut for years." This time Harper was certain the sound Allie made was a laugh, although it was choked and half muffled. Allie had her face buried against Harper's chest. At last, Allie stepped back, wiping her hands down her wet cheeks. "I know everything in camp is going bad. I know everyone is batshit crazy, my aunt especially. It's scary. She's scary. Threatening to take your baby away if Granddad dies, when you've already done everything anyone could do. That's so fucked up and sick." John sat forward, his smile fading. "What's this?"
You were unwell, Harper said, not looking directly at him, but speaking over her shoulder. I didn't want to bring it up. You look better now, by the way.
Yes, John said. Antibiotics and dragon scale have a lot in common. One is a mold that cooks bacteria, and the other is a mold that cooks us.
I wish there was a pill we could take to cure us of Carol's story. She's out of a good goddamn mind. She can't have meant it. Take your baby. What is this rubbish?
Harper said, Carol told me. She told me if Tom died, she'd hold me personally responsible and send me away. She'd keep the baby so that if I'm captured by a quarantine patrol or a cremation crew, I won't be tempted to give away any information about Camp Wyndham.
It's not just that. She really would want the baby to be safe. She wants to protect us, all of us, Allie said.
She cast her gaze around the room, looking at each of them, and her voice was almost pleading.
I know she's awful. I know she does terrible things now. Thing is, my Aunt Carol would die for the people in this camp, without a second thought. She really does love everyone, at least everyone she isn't suspicious about. And I remember before Granddad got his head bashed in, she was good then. When she knew she could help people by singing and playing music and showing them how to join the Bright, she was the best person in the world to have as your friend. I could always go cry to her if I had a fight with my mom. She made me tea and peanut butter sandwiches. So I know you guys all hate her, and I know we have to do something. But you also have to know I still love her. She's a fuck-up, but so am I. I guess it runs in the family.
John relaxed, leaned back against the wall. Decency runs in your family, Allie, and a really unsettling streak of personal daring and charisma. All the rest of us flutter around you stories like moths around candles.
Harper thought automatically of how the romance between a moth and a candle usually ended, with the moth spinning to its death, wings smoking. It didn't seem like a thought worth sharing at that particular moment. Gilbert Klein spoke up from over by the furnace. When Harper glanced at him, she noticed Gil had one hand around Renee's waist.
Sure is a relief to be out of that meat locker for a while. Next time I step out for a breath of fresh air, I'd just as soon not have to go back. Right now, though, we've got half an hour. If we've got things to figure, we better figure 'em now.
The Maz lifted his chin, was looking down the length of his bulbous nose at Harper's grocery bag.
I don't know about anyone else, but I always do my best figuring over a drink. Looks like the nurse brought just what the doctor ordered.
Harper lifted out the bottle of banana rum. Don, would you find us cups? She dashed a little rum into a collection of chipped coffee cups, tin mugs, and ugly tumblers, and Don passed them around. The last cup Harper offered to Allie.
Really?
Allie asked. It tastes better than a rock.
Allie tossed back the quarter-inch Harper had given her in a single swallow, then made a face.
Oh, God! No, it doesn't! This is piss! Like drinking gasoline after someone stirred it with a butterfinger. Or like a banana smoothie that went rotten. Horrible!
You want another slosh, then? Harper asked.
Yes, please, Allie said.
Well, too bad, Harper told her. You're a minor, and one sip is all you get. I used to eat sardines out of the can and drink the oil afterward, Don said. It was a gruesome thing to do. That oil always had little fish tails and fish eyes and fack and fish guts and little black rubbery strings of fish shit, and I drank it anyway. Just couldn't help myself.
Gil said, saw a movie where a fella said he'd eaten dogs and lived like one. I never ate a dog, but there was men that caught and ate mice in Brentwood. They called them basement chickens.
Worst thing I ever ate, the Maz speculated. I wouldn't like to go into the details in polite company, but her name was Ramona.
That's lovely, Maz. Very tasteful, Renee said.
Actually, it wasn't even a little tasteful, the Maz told her.
This reminds me. Are you going to eat the placenta? Renee asked Harper.
I understand that's a thing now. We stocked a pregnancy guide at the bookstore with a whole chapter of placenta recipes in the back. Omelets and pasta sauces and so on.
No, I don't think so, Harper said. Dining on the placenta smacks of cannibalism, and I was hoping for a more dignified apocalypse.
Rabbit mothers eat their own babies, the Maz said. I found that out reading Watership Down. Apparently the mamas chow down on their newborns all the time. Pop them down just like little meat skittles. The worst part, Allie said, is that you've all only had one drink. Don said, so who's the captain of this ship? Who's setting our course? You're so adorable when you're nautical, John Rookwood said to him. He's right, though, Renee said. That's the first order of business, isn't it? We need to hold the election.
Election? Harper asked. She was vaguely aware that she was the only person in the circle who didn't have a knowing smile on their face, a fact she found mildly irritating.
We need to settle on an evil mastermind, Renee told her. Someone to set the agenda when we have meetings. Someone to call a vote. Someone to make on-the-spot decisions when there isn't time to vote. Someone to boss around the minions.
That's silly. There's just 7 of us. 8 if you count Nick.
Don Lewiston lifted his eyebrows and turned an expectant expression toward Renee Gilmanton. You're off by 15, Renee said.
Make it 17, Don said. The McClee brothers are with us, too.
There are, what, 25 people ready to strike out on their own? Harper asked.
Dumbledore's army, she thought. The Fellowship.
Or strike out at Ben and Carol, Don said, and take back the damn camp.
He saw Allie blanch and added, strike back gently, I mean, politely, you know, with good manners.
We can do some things by way of a vote, Renee said. But working in secret as we are, a lot of choices will require an executive decision. It's a necessary job, but I don't think it's likely to be a terribly rewarding one, or particularly safe. You want to think about what might happen to whoever we put in charge, if we're discovered.
I don't need to think about it, Allie said. I know. When my aunt talks about slicing the rottenness out of camp, she's not playing with words. She's talking about cutting a bitch. She'd have people killed. She'd have to set an example.
Allie smiled at them, but looked wan.
I read in history that public executions used to be popular events. I'm sure if Aunt Carol announced one, Mrs. Held would make sure there was popcorn for everyone.
The fire cracked and hissed. A coal popped.
You really think it could go that far?
Gil asked, his voice suggesting only mild curiosity.
Public executions?
Boy, the Maz said. After the shit we seen go down in Brentwood, I'm surprised you got to ask. Myself, I can't get too worried about the consequences. I've already decided I'll do whatever I have to get out of that basement meat locker, one way or another, on my feet or on a slab.
Same, Gil said.
Harper said, but we can't vote tonight. Not if there are 15, 17 other people who want to throw in with us. How would we manage such a thing?
Don and Renee and Allie traded looks, and Harper felt once again that they were ahead of her by a step.
Harper, Renee said, we've already managed it. Everyone has already cast their vote, except for the 7 of us in this room, and maybe the McClee brothers.
Nope, Don said. They made their wishes known, too.
So it's down to just us. And let me tell you, it was hard work getting us this far. It isn't so easy to hold an election for the head of a secret society. Because I wouldn't tell anyone who was in and who wasn't. I don't like to be paranoid. But I couldn't discount the possibility that some of the people who told me they want to leave Camp Wyndham are feeding information back to Carol. For example, I never heard a single vote for Michael Lindquist. I'm sure most people would be shocked to hear he's with us. He's always been Ben Patchett's right hand. No, most of the voting condensed around the 2 or 3 really obvious candidates.
What makes someone an obvious candidate?
Anyone who isn't part of the Bright anymore. Anyone who isn't singing Carol's song. Basically, the people in this room tonight. Not only do we all still have to cast our vote, we're also all the leading candidates.
She reached into a worn, striped shoulder bag she had brought with her and came up with a tablet of yellow-lined paper. She placed it face down on an end table.
After we fill out our own ballots, I'll let you know how everyone else voted.
Renee reached into the shoulder bag again and came up with a pad of red sticky notes. She peeled squares off, one at a time, and handed them around. Don found a chipped mug with pen stuck into it and passed them out.
Do we have an official title for the man or woman who wins this thing?
Gil asked, frowning at his own blank square.
I like Master Conspirator, said the fireman. That has a nice ring, a touch of poetry and darkness to it. If you could get killed for having the job, you should at least have the pleasures of an official title with some sex appeal.
So it shall be, Renee said. Cast your vote for Master Conspirator.
There was a fidgety silence and the sounds of pens scratching on paper. When they had each finished, Renee was waiting with her tablet in hand.
Of the 15 people I spoke to, Renee began, and cleared her throat, and went on. We had 2 votes for Don, and 2 votes for Allie.
What?
Allie cried, sounding genuinely surprised. 3 for the fireman, Renee said. 4 votes for Harper, and 4 for me.
Harper flushed. Her dragon scale prickled, not unpleasantly.
Don said, When I spoke to the McClee boys, they made their intentions clear enough. They both picked Allie.
No, 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 Allie said. I don't want the fucking job. I'm 16. If I won this thing, my first act as head honcho would be to burst into tears. Besides, Robert McClee only voted for me because he has a weird crush. A muscle twitches under one eye whenever he talks to me. And the other one just does what Robert tells him. Besides, they shouldn't get a vote. Does Chris McClee even have pubic hair yet?
I agree, Fireman said. No pubes, no vote. And since I'm against child sacrifice, I'm in favor of allowing Allie to unnominate herself. Did anyone who voted for Allie have a backup choice?
As it happens, Renee said, peering at her pad.
They do. One person chose John as an alternate. The other selected Don.
Fack, Don said.
Did the McClee brothers have a backup choice? Renee asked. It wouldn't matter if they did, Don said, since we agree they're too young to vote.
Which was how Harper knew they had also picked Don as a backup.
That's 3 for Don, and 4 for Harper, John, and myself.
Better make it 5 for you, Renee,
Gil said, unfolding his sticky and setting it on the table before him.
You did most of the planning and thinking that took us this far. I don't see any reason to change horses now.
Renee leaned toward him and lightly kissed his cheek.
You are such a kind and sweet man, Gil. I will ignore that you just called me a horse.
The man said, And 5 for the fireman.
Raising his own sticky so the rest of the room could have a look.
I seen him literally bring hell down on the Portsmouth PD. That makes him the man in my book.
Don unfolded his own sticky and said, Me, myself? I voted Harper. I seen the way she handled the infirmary and Father Story was brought in, and I seen the way she drilled into his head.
He lifted his roomy blue eyes and met Harper's gaze.
The worse things get, the more people are screaming and crying and carrying on, the calmer you get, Nurse Willows. I couldn't stop shaking, and your hand was as steady as a board. I want you for it. We still have a 3-way tie for the lead.
Not anymore.
Make it 6 for Harper, Allie said.
I think it ought to be her, too, because I know no matter how bad I fuck up, she won't ever stick a stone in my mouth and make me feel like Judas, even though after what I did, God knows she'd have every right.
Oh, Allie, Harper said, you apologized once. I don't expect you to do it over and over.
It's not an apology. It's a vote, Allie said, meeting Harper's gaze almost with defiance. Yes, it is. Renee said, and my vote is for Harper, too. It is awfully good of some people to have asked me to take the job, but I'd rather read about a grand escape than plan one. Besides, I'm terrible at keeping secrets, and I hate to scheme against people. It seems rude. I don't deal with guilt well, and I'm worried we might hurt some feelings in the process of defending ourselves. Also, I'm juggling a couple of books. Being a full-time conspirator would take away from my reading time. So it'll have to be Harper.
Hey, Harper said. I've got books to read too, lady.
It also crossed my mind that you are very pregnant, and I think that makes it much, much less likely they'll hang you if we're caught, Renee said. And Harp, I hate to break it to you, but I think this puts you in charge. By my count, you just won the vote, 5-7.
Make it 6-7, Harper said, because I voted for John.
What a coincidence.
The fireman opened his mouth in a toothy grin that made him look just mildly deranged.
So did I.
opening his vote and turning it to show what he had written there. A single word. Myself. 9. 10 minutes later, the others were gone. Only Harper and the fireman remained behind. "Tell Michael I'll be along in a few hours and not to worry," Harper told Don Lewiston. Renee leaned in from outside, through the half-open door, her hand on the latch. "Don't forget to come back, Harper," Renee said, her very blue eyes glittering from the cold or from delight. It was hard to say. "Go on, you," Harper said. "Hurry! Don't you know the first rule of running a conspiracy? Don't get caught." The door closed. Harper and the fireman heard whispers, choked laughter, Allie singing a line of Love Shack, and then the crunch of boots moving away. Finally, it was just the two of them again, in a taut but agreeable silence, the kind of silence that precedes a first kiss. They didn't kiss, though. Harper was aware of the open furnace at her back, the heat cast by the shifting flames, and wondered who was watching. He had gotten up twice to feed driftwood to the fire, and each time she thought, "If we abandon Camp Wyndham, he won't be with us. He has to stay here and tend his private flames." "It was a setup," she said. "You guys counted the votes ahead of time." "Well, I wouldn't go that far. Let's just say the outcome was not entirely unforeseen. Why do you think Michael made a special point to let you know there was no rush to return tonight?" There had been time, when they were all together, to sketch two different plans in broad outline. One imagined what they would do if they had to leave in a hurry. The other plotted a method to gently wrest control of camp away from Carol. It had been left to John and Harper to work out the details for both eventualities. "I'm ready to hatch schemes if you are," he said. "I need sugar for my best scheming," she said, found her canvas tote, and tugged out a Mary Poppins lunchbox. "Nothing gets me in a conspiratorial mood like an illicit candy bar, even if they are a year old." His brow knotted. "I warn you. Claiming to have candy bars when you don't would be a gross violation of your Hippocratic oath never to inflict needless suffering. I have news for you, Rookwood. I'm a nurse. We don't take the Hippocratic oath. That's just doctors. Nurses only swear to one thing. The patient will take his medicine." "Sometimes you say something just a bit menacing, and it gives me a happy little shiver," he said. And then, without any change of tone or hesitation, he added, "I'd burn Camp Wyndham to the ground before I'd let Carol and her sycophants take your baby from you. There'd be nothing left of this place but charred sticks. I hope you know that." "Wouldn't be very fair to the rest of them, would it?" Harper asked. "They're not bad people, most of them. All they want is to be safe." "Isn't that always a permission slip for ugliness and cruelty? All they want is to be safe, and they don't care who they have to destroy to stay that way. And the people who want to kill us, the cremation crews, all they want is safety too. And the man I killed with the Phoenix the other night, the man behind the 50 caliber, I felt I had to do it. I had to cook him down to the bones. It was the only way I could know for sure you'd get back to me." He looked at her with a curious mix of bemusement and grief. She wanted to take his hand. Instead, she gave him a miniature Snickers and took a tiny Mounds bar for herself. "Are we going to have to kill people to be safe?" Her voice was very quiet. "Do you think it will come to that? With Ben? With Carol? Because if you do, I think maybe I should row back to shore now. I don't want to make a plan to murder anyone." "If you row back to shore now," he said, "it might murder me. So I guess you'll have to stay." "I guess so," she said, and poured them each a little more rum. 10. He said the candy bar was awful, and he needed another one to get the taste out of his mouth. She gave him a cigarette instead and another splash of rum. He lit up with his thumb. Harper wasn't too sure about the escape plan. It had too many moving parts. She had a list going, beginning with the letter A. Father Story is responsive. Continuing on through E, create a distraction by dropping the bell in the steeple, and finishing with Q, Don leads the other boats north. That was way too much of the alphabet. The fireman, on the other hand, loved the plan. Of course he did. He had the starring role. Harper kept trying to subtract letters, and he kept trying to add them. "I wish we had time to dig a tunnel," the fireman said. "To where? It doesn't matter. You can't have a decent prison breakout without a tunnel. The aspiring novelist in me wants a secret tunnel hidden behind a false wall, or a poster of a famous movie star, or possibly in the back of a wardrobe. We could call it Operation Narnia. Don't tell me you wouldn't like that." "I wouldn't like it if you turned into a novelist. I might have to tear off half your face. That's what I did with the last wannabe writer to cross my path." He swished the dregs of his banana liquor around his paper cup and then tossed the last of it back. "I forgot your husband was an aspiring novelist. Sometimes I think every man wants to be a writer. They want to invent a world with the perfect imaginary woman, someone they can boss around and undress at will. They can work out their own aggression with a few fictional rape scenes. Then they can send their fictional surrogate in to save her, a white knight or a fireman. Someone with all the power and all the agency. Real women, on the other hand, have all these tiresome interests of their own and won't follow an outline." A glumness settled upon her. It crossed her mind that she had never been Jacob's friend or wife or lover, but only his subject, only material. Writers were as parasitic, she supposed, as the spore itself. "I am in 100% agreement on the subject of outlines. Any writer who works by outline should be burned at the stake, possibly with their own outline and note cards used as kindling. That's what I dislike most about our plan. It's an outline. Life doesn't work by outline. If I was writing this scene, I wouldn't even bother describing our plan, not in any detail. I already know it won't work out the way we're hoping. It would just be wasting the reader's time." He saw the look on her face and kicked her foot. "Oh, come on. We have candy bars and smokes and booze and evil plans. Don't get morose on me. What else is in that lunchbox of yours?" She took out a deformed, tumorous potato and set it on the bed. The fireman recoiled. "Ah, what the awful bearded Christ is that?" "That? That's Yukon Gold, Chumley," she said. "Ah, well," he said, "I suppose we've had enough chocolate. How about a baked potato?" He picked it up and clasped it between his hands. Smoke began to rise from between his fingers, and with it, the smell of roasting spuds. The smell cheered Harper up. She couldn't help it. "I love a man who knows how to cook," Harper said. 11. He had salt and a little tumbler of olive oil, and they split the potato. The fragrant mineral smell of it filled the shed. It was so good, it made Harper feel a little teary, and when it was gone, she licked oil and salt off her hands. "You know what I miss?" she said. "If you say Facebook, you'll ruin a perfectly lovely evening." "I miss Coca-Cola. That would have been so good with a Coke. You know, we might have fucked up the planet, sucking out all the oil, melting ice caps, allowing ska music to flourish. But we made Coca-Cola, so goddammit, people weren't all bad. As a species, we might not live to regret melting the ice caps. That's where it comes from, you know, the spore. I'm 80% sure. That's why all the earliest cases were along the Arctic Circle. It was under the glaciers. I think it's happened before, too. Everyone believed the dinosaurs were wiped out by a meteor strike, but I figure it was the spore. It hides under the ice until the world warms up enough to let it back into the air. Then it burns everything until the world is so blanketed in smoke, the planet freezes over again. The mold dies out, except for a little bit that is preserved once more under the ice. There have been 6 extinction events in the life of this planet. I bet every one of them was the spore. You're saying it's a planetary T-cell. It attacks any infection that throws the environment out of whack. Like us. He nodded. That's the third best theory I've ever heard. I like the idea that the Russians bred a super fungus back in the 70s, out on this island for testing biological weapons. Rebirth Island, I think it was called. They had to abandon the site in 2000 after the spore got loose. But the island was in a lake that dried up and animals crossed back and forth, carrying the ash in their fur. All the early cases were in Russia.
You said third best theory. Is there something better than Arctic melt or a Russian island of pure evil?
I also like the idea that God is punishing us with killer athlete's foot for wearing Crocs.
She gave herself another tipple of banana liquor.
In her medical opinion, another sip wouldn't give the baby a deformed brain.
Now that the world is over, what do you most regret not getting to do?
Julianne Moore, he said, and Gillian Anderson. At the same time or separately, it really would have made no difference.
I mean, what did you want to do that actually might have happened?
I wish I had discovered a new kind of mold I could have named after Sarah.
Wow, you romantic son of a bitch.
What about Harper Willows? What did you always want to do?
Me?
Julianne Moore, same as you. That hot little bitch had one fine ass.
The fireman went and got a dish towel and apologized over and over for spitting his banana rum on her while he patted her shirt dry.
12. He got up to stir the fire and came back holding the longbow that had sat in the corner all winter long. He stretched out on his cot, holding the bow as if it were a guitar and thwanging its one atonal string.
"Do you think Keith Richards is still alive?" he asked.
"Sure. Nothing can kill him. He'll outlast us all."
"Beatles or Stones?" he asked.
She sang the opening lines of Love Me Do.
"Is that a vote for the Beatles?"
"Of course I picked the Beatles. It's a stupid question. It's like asking what you like better, silk or pubic hair."
"Aw, that's disappointing."
"Of course you'd pick the Stones. Anyone who'd walk around pretending he's a fireman when he isn't.
What does that have to do with anything?"
"Men who love the Stones are fixated on cock. I'm sorry, but that's the only word. And a fire hose is a symbolic fantasy cock. It's pathetic. Male Stones fans are frozen at 18 months old, just discovering the thrill of yanking on the rubber band of their own phallus. Female Stones fans are even worse. Mick Jagger has a weird, gross mouth that makes him look like a cod, and this turns them on. They're sexually aroused by fishmen. They're deviants. So what are Beatles fans fixated on? The glory of pussy?"
"Exactly.
Strawberry Fields is not just a park in London, Mr. Rookwood." She held out her hand.
"Give me that."
"Every time you twang the cable, you're putting unnecessary torque on the cams."
"You talk like an auto mechanic when you're drunk. Did you know that?"
"I'm not drunk. You're drunk. I'm a former archery instructor. Now give it." He gave her the bow. She stood it upright, ran her fingers down the slick of the cable.
"An archery instructor?"
"When I was in high school, for the town rec department."
"What inspired you?"
"Jennifer Lawrence."
"Did you have cat's-ass Everdame fantasies?"
"Jennifer Lawrence was a corker. I hope she didn't burn to death."
"No, this was pre-Hunger Games. I went on this whole Robin Hood jag when I was 9 years old. I started saying thy and thou, and when my parents asked me to do a chore, I'd drop to one knee and bow.
At the peak of my obsession, I wore a Robin Hood costume to school."
"For Halloween?"
"No, just because I liked the way it made me feel."
"Oh, God. And your parents let you? I didn't know you were neglected as a child. That gives me a sad feeling in my..."
He paused to try and figure out where his sad feelings were located.
"Emotions."
"My parents are sturdy, practical people who own several rat-like dogs. They were very good to me, and I miss them very much. I'm sorry for your loss."
"I don't think they're dead,
but they are in Florida. The first stage of decline." He nodded sadly.
"I suppose they dress their dogs in sweaters.
Sometimes, if it's cold.
But how did you know?"
"They let you cavort about in public wearing a Robin Hood outfit, to what I can only assume was a deluge of cruel taunts from your peers. It's easy enough to guess how they'll treat their pets."
"Oh, no. They didn't know about my Robin Hood outfit.
I had it in my backpack and changed into it in the bathroom at school.
But you're right about the taunts.
That was a dark day for Harper Francis Willows."
"Francis. Lovely. May I call you Franny?"
"No, you may call me Harper."
She rested her chin on the top of the bow.
"My dad got me my first bow for Christmas, when I was 10, but he took it away before New Year's.
Did you shoot someone?
He caught me soaking arrows in lighter fluid. I just really, really wanted to shoot a flaming arrow at something. It didn't matter what. Still do. I feel like that would complete me, to see a burning arrow go thwack into something and set it afire. I suppose it's how men feel when they imagine sinking balls deep into the perfect piece of ass. I just want one sexy little thwack.
John choked on another mouthful of banana rum. She had to pound him between the shoulders to get him breathing again.
I am certain you are drunk, he said.
No, she said.
I've limited myself to a very responsible 2 cups of banana-flavored dog vomit. I'm pregnant. He gasped, began to cough once more.
Come on, she said. Let's go shoot flaming arrows. Want to?
The fresh air will do you good. You need to get out of this hole more often. He gave her a look through watering eyes.
What are we going to shoot?
The moon.
Ah, he said. A nice fat target.
Do I get to shoot, too?
Sure, she said, and pushed back her chair.
I'll get the arrows.
All you have to do is bring the fire.
13. The cold was so sharp after the banana-scented heat of the fireman's shed, it drove the breath out of her and stung her cheeks like a slap. She led him around the shed, up through the long, tough seagrass, and down the dune to the ocean-facing side of the island, out of sight from shore. When he struggled in the sand, she reached back and took his hand to help him along. They stopped at one corner of the big cruising sloop, sitting in its steel carriage. From here, Harper could see the name written across the stern in sparkling gold cursive. The Bobby Shaw. The Bobby Shaw featured prominently in their plans, appearing in steps F, H, and M through Q. The fireman looked around, wearing his rubber fireman's jacket like a cape and clutching himself inside of it. Finally he found what he was hunting for. The moon, an ice-colored button pinned to the black cape of the sky.
There it is. Kill it so we can go back inside where it's warm.
She had the bow in one hand, a clutch of arrows in the other. She dropped all but one of the arrows onto the blue shale, held the last out to him, point first. Got a light? He closed his fist around the black carbon of the arrow and slid his hand along it. Blue fire followed, as if the arrow were soaked in gasoline and he had touched a match to it. She knocked the arrow and sighted along the burning shaft. Fire lashed off it in a red banner.
She aimed for the moon and let go.
A blazing red comet sliced through the darkness. The arrow climbed 200 feet, hooked hard to the right, and dropped in a shower of embers. She held the bow over her head, feeling joyously savage.
"Isn't that beautiful?" he said.
She turned his hand over and looked at his palm.
"And it didn't hurt?"
"Not even a little. It isn't so hard to understand. Not really. The dragon scale will burn a host to the ground if it has to, but it won't destroy itself. I taught it to stop thinking of me as a host. I hacked the code and reprogrammed it to forget there's any difference between me and it. I hate when you explain things. By the time you're done explaining something, I always feel like I know less than I did before you started talking.
Look at it this way, Willows. You know it's in your brain. You know it feels, just not in words. Feed it stress and panic, it'll read that as a threat, and will burst into flame to start its reproductive cycle and escape. Feed it harmony and contentment and a sense of belonging, and it will read that as security. It doesn't just sense your pleasure, but amplifies it. It provides you with pleasurable feedback, gives you the world's cheapest high. But in both cases, it's not acting, it's reacting.
What Nick taught me.
What?
Harper said.
Nick? What Nick taught you?
He blinked at her, flustered, losing his way.
Yes, well, obviously not anymore, not after...
He shook his head, waved a dismissive hand in the air.
Why are you bringing Nick into this anyway? You're throwing me off.
I didn't bring Nick into it, she was going to say. You did.
She even got as far as opening her mouth. Then she shut it again and let him go on.
When you're all together in church, you sing to it. It likes that. That's how you pacify it. But you're still mucking about with words, and it doesn't care about words. There was some writer who said language is no way to communicate, and the dragon scale couldn't agree more. All those words in your head are constant reminders that you're a host. You have to think about what you want the dragon scale to do for you without words. Imagine what it must be like to be deaf, to think deaf thoughts, with sign as your first and primary language. Like Nick, Harper murmured. Yes, if you like, he said, waving a hand in the air again, as if brushing off an irritating midge. Nick can feel the thump of a drumbeat in his bones, and if you teach him the lyrics to a song, he will sing to himself, but in the wordless words of the deaf. If you can sing to the dragon scale without words, then you're speaking its language. Then it no longer looks at you as separate, but as the same. That's all I did. That's all I ever do. I sing it one of my favorite songs, but without words. I sing for my coat of flame and my sword of fire, and the dragon scale produces them.
And Nick taught you how? Nick can do it too?
Cast flame. Like you. He gave her a bleary, baffled, miserable look. Then, in a voice so soft she hardly heard, he said, "Quite a bit better than me, actually." She nodded. "But not any more." The fireman shook his head. She absorbed that, decided they could return to it later. "What song do you sing to it?" "Ah, you don't know it." Waving the hand again and looking away. She thought, though, he was relieved to be off the subject of Nick. "Although I thought when I met you, well, one of the first things you said to me was a line from the song. For a half moment I thought I had encountered someone who loved Dire Straits as much as myself." She stepped back from him, swayed in the frozen air, shut her eyes, inhaled deeply, and began to sing in a soft, low-pitched, tuneful hush. "A love-struck Romeo sings the streets a serenade, laying everybody low with a love song that he made. Finds a street light, steps out of the shade, says something like, 'You and me, babe, how about it?'" She opened her eyes. He stared at her with his mouth hanging open, eyes bright and watery, as if he might start crying. "You're glowing," he said. "You're singing my favorite song in the world, and you're glowing like a diamond on an engagement ring." She looked down and noticed it was true. Her throat was a collar of coral light. She was shining through her sweater. He leaned toward her and kissed her then, a warm, affectionate kiss that tasted of rum and coffee and butter and pecans and cigarettes and Englishmen. He drew back, looked at her uncertainly. "I'm sorry," he said. "I hope not. You taste like a candy bar. A spoonful of sugar, I understand, does make the medicine go down." "Is it medicine?" "An important part of your recovery. Take two and call me in the morning."
"Two?"
She kissed him again, then pulled back and laughed at his expression. "Come on now, John. Your turn to shoot. You'll be good at it. You're English. You have the blood of Robin Hood coursing in your veins. Here." She gave him the bow, showed him where to put his hands, kicked at his feet to make him spread his legs. "You pull the cable to the corner of your mouth like this," she said, miming it for him. "Practice without an arrow for a moment." He practiced, swaying in the bitter cold, his nostrils red and the rest of his face the color of pale wax. "How's that? Do I look like Errol Flynn?" "You are a dashing motherfucker," she told him. She picked an arrow off the rocks, held it in one fist, closed her eyes, and frowned in concentration. "What are you doing there?" She didn't look at him, but felt his gaze upon her and was glad. In that moment she knew she was going to do it. It was like knowing you were going to hit a bullseye before the arrow left the bow. Harper saw it in her head, the way she would move her hands in sequence to say, "You and me, babe. How about it?" without using any words at all. She saw it all, and in that moment she knew how easy it was. You didn't have to do anything to connect with the dragon scale. In that way, it was just like being pregnant. She felt the song in her tendons and nerve endings, felt it flow like blood, without a sound, without words, without even the memory of words. You and me, babe, how about it? She lit up. Harper opened her eyes to see the cup of her hand spurt a heatless flame, a blue mystic flame, all around the arrow, and she cried out in shock and dropped it. The fireman snatched at her arm and clapped her hand under his turnout jacket to extinguish the blaze. Red freckles appeared high in his cheeks. His eyes strained behind his glasses. "What are you doing?"
"Nothing," she said.
"What in God's name do you think you're doing? Do you want to die?"
I just wanted to see."
But he had turned away, his coat flapping, and began to lurch back up the dune. She caught up to him at the top of the ridge, the highest point of the island. The shed was below, built right into the side of the slope. Moss and seagrass carpeted the roof. She tried to take his shoulder, but he spun around, throwing her hand off him. He gave her a bewildered, bookish look, eyes straining behind his square glasses. "Is that what this is all about? Get me drunk and make out with me to see if you can trick me into teaching you how to burn yourself to death?"
"No, John, no. I kissed you because I felt like kissing you."
"Do you know what happened to the last person who decided she wanted to pull a burning rabbit out of a hat?"
"I know what happened."
"No, you don't. You have no idea. She turned to cinders."
As he spoke, he was backing unsteadily away from her. "I know she died. I know it was terrible."
"Shut up. You don't know anything except I have something you want, and you'll do whatever you need to get it. Booze me up, flounce around, fuck me if necessary."
"No," she said. She felt she was caught in nettles. She couldn't struggle free, and everything she said was just another step deeper into the thorny tangle.
"John, please. You don't know what happened to her. You don't know what's still happening to her. You don't understand a thing about us." He threw the bow over the side of the roof, which was when she realized he had retreated out onto the top of his shed. He reeled back another step. "Get away from me, and never do what you just did again."
He held out his hands. Golden light throbbed in his dragon scale. His palms became shallow dishes, brimming with flame.
"Unless you want to burn like this forever."
"John, stop it. Stop moving.
Just stay where you are and..."
He wasn't listening. He took another step back and spread his arms.
Wings of brightest fire spread in a cape from his hands down to his sides. Black smoke gushed from his nostrils. "Unless you want to be in hell for the rest of your life," he said. "Like ma-ma-ma-ma-ma."
His eyes widened with surprise. He began to whirl his arms around and around for balance, drawing flaming hoops in the air. His right foot slid out from under him and down the roof. He dropped to one knee, lunged, and grabbed a fistful of grass. For one moment of perfect stillness, he hung at a crooked angle. The long, tough grass turned to threads of copper and burnt away in his hot hand.
"John!" she cried.
He dropped, banged down the tin roof, off the edge, and into the night. She heard him hit the dune with a thud, a thump, a gasp, a soft whump. Silence.
"Nothing broken," he called. "Don't worry, I'm all right."
He was quiet again.
"Except maybe my wrist," he said,
in a suddenly disconsolate voice. Harper closed her eyes and exhaled with relief.
"Ow," the fireman said.
14. After she popped the lunate back into place, it went in with a meaty thwack and a shrill cry, and retaped the wrist, she made him drink 2 ladles of frosty water and swallow 4 Advil. She forced him to lay down and then spooned against him in his cot for one, her arm around his waist.
"You asshole," she said. "You're lucky you didn't smash in those ribs again."
He put his injured hand over hers. "I'm sorry," he said, "about what I said."
"Do you want to tell me about it? About what happened to her?"
"No," he said.
"Yes. Do you really want to hear? She thought she already knew much of it, but she squeezed his thumb between her fingers to let him know she was ready to listen. He sighed, a weary, haggard sound.